This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Hoosiers in the know. Get their answers from a program that does the talking, Indiana Week in Review. You may tune in for the news, but you'll stay for the no-holds-barred debate and discussion that comes up. It's a look at the issues that are facing Indiana from differing viewpoints.
Governor Holcomb officially launches his re-election campaign. Susan Brooks breaks with her party over a rebuke of Donald Trump. Plus, Buttigieg speaks to young Dems in Indy and more on Indiana Week in Review. Republican Governor Eric Holcomb kicked off his re-election campaign at the Hoosier Gym in Knightstown with a new slogan, Putting People First.
Holcomb seeks to center his campaign on individual success stories that match up with his priorities as governor. Holcomb touted past accomplishments, workforce development, tackling the opioid epidemic, and infrastructure investments, while looking forward with an emphasis on improving infant mortality, the Department of Child Services, and job training for inmates. Holcomb officially begins his re-election bid with a sizable financial advantage, more than $6 million in his campaign war chest.
Just how comfortable will this re-election campaign be for Eric Holcomb? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, putting people first. Will that be the winning strategy for Eric Holcomb?
Right after swine, right? We can spend $44 million on the swine bar, but heaven forbid we should give teachers the raises that they're entitled to or the kids the education that they're entitled to. I mean, it's a slogan. It doesn't mean anything. And certainly it isn't even consistent with his conduct. But I think that was it was a nice event, obviously, by all accounts.
You were invited.
by all accounts, it was a nice event, and it's good for him to introduce himself to the people of Indiana, none of whom know him. So it'll be good to see how he can, begin to sell himself.
Governor Holcomb, if there's been a criticism, a consistent criticism of him, is that he hasn't put forward the big ideas.
How about even the little ones?
He hasn't put forward a lot of big ideas in his time as governor. So is putting people first telegraphing a big idea?
Well, I think putting people first reflects what he has been doing, which is, you know, if he gets out of bed every day concerned about things that affect average people or people in the state. So he cares about infrastructure. He cares about, if you're addicted to drugs, he cares about opioid use reduction. If you're in prison and you're coming out, he cares about making sure you have a certificate or some way that you're not going to go back. He cares about workforce development. Are you in the next level jobs program, finishing high school, getting a work certificate, going to college? How are we improving people's lives? And Eric Holcomb is a lot like Mitch Daniels in that he views his time as governor, that he's a governor for everybody. And so he's not going to attach himself to some niche kind of political partisan issue necessarily. He's going to look for things that affect the most people that need it and that state government can help. And that's been the theme of his first 2.5 years. And it's going to be rhetorically the theme going forward.
I want to ask this. He just said that Eric Holcomb is like Mitch Daniels in that these are the things he's focused on. But it felt like with Mitch Daniels, you could immediately attach, for better or for worse.
We had 16 years of Democrats, and nothing happened. So we had a lot of
pipeline. Okay, so
we
then
need to weed the garden, just as so Mitch Daniels said after 16 years.
Well, then is that the problem? Is that after how many years of Republican
BMV
leadership?
Waiting lines? He shortened the lines at the BMV and then changed daylight saving time. Once those issues are done, what's left
what's
to conquer in Indiana?
I mean, balance the budget. We continue to do the things that Mitch Daniels did, which include balance the budget. We have a record surplus. We have record investments in education.
Baby steps. And like, for example, when he says that he's
saving $3 million.
$3 million if he funds the infrastructure the way he's talking about. And in several years, that'll make some difference to teachers. $100 a piece.
Maybe a lightning bolt will come down. But does every successful politician have to lay out some 4,000-part
apparently
plan?
Apparently not. That, no, he's got about 60%
okay, that upends the status quo. I mean, he has doubled down on good government, pragmatic government, that his mantra has been for everybody. Again, not there have
like
been
the
there have been partisans on both sides who say, I'm going to gin up my base, I'm going to throw a little red meat here, a little red meat there, and then I'll govern at the margins. I think this is a different approach. And maybe it comes about because, as an electorate, it had grown reform-weary. I mean, how many times have we reformed education? How many times have we reformed?
I'm not talking about reforming education. I'm talking about paying
taxes. Let me ask this, though, then. Fundamentally, really, does Eric Holcomb just not need to screw up too bad and he'll be fine?
Yeah, look, I mean, you can't say never say never, but he obviously has, you know, he's in a commanding position. You know, I think the one thing that is kind of out there on the edge is if teachers coalesce in an organized way. The putting people first thing was your slogan, but I just thought when John was talking, maybe it should be like, not sexy, but solid. You know, I mean, maybe that's his thing.
That is exactly his performance. It's solid, in the sense that he hasn't done anything that changes anything, and so therefore he hasn't screwed up, except perhaps with the VA. But you know, other than that,
but if you look at things such as budgetary reserves, you look at a relatively robust economy.
We're not a bank. The reason you have the reserves and the credit rating is to
the biggest contrast right now is because we're in
a campaign. We have a governor who has raised a record amount of money. We've got a senior staff that's coming back to run this campaign. We've got the best state party we've ever had. No, everybody but me. But we have record dollars. We have a record organization. And right now that matters a lot if you contrast it to Democrats who have no money, who have a candidate who lives in New York City and has been trying to sell his house here for 3 years.
All right.
And nothing.
Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we post an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, will Governor Eric Holcomb win a second term in 2020? A yes or B no? Last week's question, would State Superintendent of Public Instruction Jennifer McCormick, a Republican, make a good lieutenant governor candidate for Democrats in 2020? 62% of you said she would, but 38% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to WFYI.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, 5th District Representative Susan Brooks was one of only four Republicans in the U.S. House this week to vote for a resolution condemning President Trump's recent racist attack against four Democratic congresswomen.
Trump tweeted Sunday that four members of Congress, all Democrats and women of color, should go back to their countries. Such language has long been used as a racist attack against people of color, besides the fact that three of the four congresswomen were born in the U.S. Republican Congresswoman Susan Brooks issued a statement on social media, calling Trump's comments inappropriate and saying they don't reflect American values. She then became one of four House GOP members to vote for a resolution to strongly condemn the president for the tweets. Brooks announced last month she won't run for re-election next year.
Mike O'Brien, is it a coincidence that Brooks isn't running again and voted for this resolution?
It made it easier, right? I mean, you save yourself the blowback. I mean, I think the reasons that she said that she's not running for re-election are the motivating ones, which is they're in a different part of life. Kids are all over the country and grown, and they want to spend time. They want to invest their time there. So I think that's real. But I'm sure she analyzed these types of situations. If she did, and I'm sure she did, because otherwise you couldn't make a complete decision. And this is incredibly, 2 weeks ago, I really thought there was a path, and I still do, on the policy of immigration policy. I thought Republicans, because Democrats had gone so far to the left on open borders, on buying health care, on some of the policy planks that they've adopted and pushed, that it gave Republicans a window to come in and say, look, we need rational policies at the border because we have a record number of illegal crossings every day. It's three times what it was 2 years ago. But then you have people, you know, you have protesters to ICE showing up at detention facilities with guns and throwing Molotov cocktails in, and they're getting shot. And it's just crazy. But what we're going to lose that is if the president continues to do this. I mean, Congresswoman Omar should be the example of successful immigration policy. I mean, this woman was born in Somalia, in war-torn Somalia, comes to the United States, becomes a citizen, gets elected to Congress. Nobody in that rally the other day could do that. Or would, frankly. And so we got to get out of the president has to get out of his own way on immigration policy, because I do think there's a path there. This is going to be a vigorous debate in the 2020 election, but it can't be if this is going to be the window dressing for it.
Susan Brooks was the only Republican, certainly from Indiana, to vote for the resolution. And she's also in arguably the most winnable district for Democrats, flippable district for Democrats next year. So will any of the other Republicans who didn't vote for it be held accountable for that in any way?
No, I don't think so. But I think that her vote on this is the best indicator that that district is trending Democratic. I mean, finally, she's out from under the yoke of having to march to the Republican parade there that Donald Trump can do no wrong. I mean, she's been embarrassed by him numerous times in the past, and this is the first time she felt emboldened enough, because she isn't running again, to speak out. You know, and that's, you know, that's to her credit. And I wish more of the Republican Party would do the same. Democrats are not for open borders. The question was, health care is already provided to illegal aliens through emergency rooms.
Those are debates I have as a standalone matter for people that are here.
We need legislation, and we needed legislation when Republicans were in control of both houses of Congress and the presidency, and did we get it? No. So the problem is not that the Democrats have moved too far to the left. The problem is the Republicans want to demonize anybody seeking asylum in the United States, and they want to label them all as either terrorists or rapists or murderers. That's the problem.
Over the last few years, there's been a
lot
of talk.
Some of them are
good people.
Over the last few years, we've heard a lot of talk about racist dog whistles. I would say this is just a whistle. Is with as short an attention span as we have anymore, is this the sort of issue, though, that has legs months out?
I don't know. These things flare up with President Trump all the time. And in the moment, you think, oh, my God, this is huge. And then, like, 4 days later, it's fine. So
Because there's something else happens, right.
So I've lost track of what is going to be able to stick to the wall, so to speak. I will point out that, you know, none of Indiana's other congresspeople spoke out. So I think it's fair to say they are just fine with the president's words.
And again, I'll ask the same question. Is there any consequence for them on that?
No, I don't think so. There's no doubt that retiring emboldens people. In fact, Fred Upton from Michigan, and one of the other three individuals, Republicans, he's on a lot of retirement watch lists, so there is some rumor that he might be retiring too. And then if you look at the others, Will Hurd from Texas and Ryan Fitzpatrick from Pennsylvania, they're in districts, either they're in districts where they have felt a need to moderate their positions and vote Democratic.
Hurd is in a really diverse district.
He's in a diverse district, and then
Fitzpatrick
especially so. So, I mean, not altogether unexpected, but it's what this does. We shouldn't think about this, I don't think, as if does Donald Trump, you know, will he be able to avoid another one of these dust-ups? Because actually, this is, I think, if you look at history, his go-to strategy when he feels that either he wants to focus attention elsewhere or that he needs to gin up the base. This is what he does. Now, the only challenge is, of course, it does, I think, gin up a portion of his base, clearly. But it also
invigorates
the other side. So I think you have people who are a lot more frustrated, to say it euphemistically, with the president, this week after these comments than they were even a week ago. So it cuts both ways.
This is part of the strategy. It's part of the strategy.
Is it a strategy, though?
Oh, I think it is, because every time he has a failure, he does something like this or says something like this, so all the media attention's diverted from the fact that the ICE raids didn't happen.
Tactically, he does do that. This situation, I mean, given how he's treated the rally and the send her back situation in the days that have fought in the last 48 hours, he's changed his position three times on whether or not he supported it or not. I mean, you try to walk it back and say, look, I don't support that, which is the right
position to take, and
a recognition that politically, this
but
real,
there's
this,
video.
The well, staying yeah, power yeah. here is going to be so, every rally between now and next November
so
is going to include send her back.
So Pete Buttigieg talked about that very thing yesterday when he issued a generational call to arms this week as he addressed the Young Democrats of America's National Convention here in Indianapolis.
Buttigieg referenced the recent controversy over President Trump's racist tweets, condemning them while cautioning Democrats not to allow Trump to, quote, steal all the oxygen from the conversation.
We need to make them answer to our agenda, because ours is the agenda of the American people.
But Buttigieg was also met with chants of Black Lives Matter amid criticism of his record with communities of color. He acknowledged those chants and that criticism.
We've laid out what I believe is the most comprehensive plan in the 2020 field on what we're specifically going to do with intention to dismantle systemic racism in this country. The plan's very well received, but I got a lot of work to do to go out and communicate it.
John Schwanis, Buttigieg has stalled in the polls recently after that big upward climb. What does he need to do to regain that momentum that he had?
I'm not sure that there's a secret formula of lightning in the bottle, as you might say. Part of this is to be expected. If you look, again, I use history as a guide. It hasn't served me well in recent cycles, but if you go back far enough, it tends to help. And you look to front runners, at people who sort of come onto the scene quickly, those that were really an unknown a month before. everybody focuses on those individuals, and all of a sudden, some of the flaws and the blemishes that it wears off. I mean, it's just natural. The more you know, familiarity, I guess, may breed contempt to a certain extent in politics as well. So a lot of times, if you look at any both parties in the last 10 cycles, you see people who jump out a little bit because they're unknown. You can sort of read into them whatever you want them to be. They're the
heroes. But
then
you start to define them.
But then you start to define them, and every time they take a position, well, maybe some people say,
stand back and wait and see.
But I think it's just natural.
We have another set of Democratic debates here in a couple weeks.
Right.
Does Buttigieg need a breakout moment from those debates?
Well, it would obviously help. I mean, right now he's got all the stuff going for him. He's a phenomenon right now. You know, he's raising ridiculous amounts of money, T-shirts and chants, and, you know. But he's got to take that next step so that he's sort of a long-haul candidate. And that would really help. Also, I think if there was some clarity in the whole shooting situation in South Bend, it might help.
Yeah. He raised more than any other Democratic candidate in the second quarter. Does that money need to start to turn into results in early state polls?
I think they will. I think as those debates occur, he acquits himself extremely well in those. He is sensible. He is moderate. He is thoughtful. And he is bright as well as articulate. And I think he stands out in the civility that he brings to those events as well. So I think that the bumps will come as the stage shrinks in going ahead, and the more that allows more focus on him. And I think he's going to do extremely well.
We saw what a breakout moment in the debate can do when Kamala Harris, skyrocketed up into this top tier now. Mm-hmm. And we're starting to get a sense of this top tier pulling away as Biden, Sanders, Warren, Harris, and then a little drop to Buttigieg and then a big drop to everybody else.
Right.
To avoid widening that gap between him and the rest of the top four, does he absolutely need to have a breakout moment in the next debate?
Well, I don't think it's a killer if he doesn't. I mean, because as this field narrows, but it becomes more risky and it becomes more pointed because you've got fewer targets to shoot at, right? I mean, there's like 10 people on each. There's 20 people on the entire debate stage. So there's not a lot of opportunity to really focus in on one candidate. But if he had a Senator Harris moment, then yeah, he it kind of cements him. It cements him in that small group.
Yeah.
I mean, right now being at 4%
is fine. You can't ever be sure
in
a debate that large whether the opportunity presents itself.
Right. But I mean, she saw an opportunity and grabbed it.
And she grabbed it. No, it was very effective.
At this point, he's like the Eric Holcomb of presidential candidates. He came from relative obscurity, and now he's skyrocketed to the top of the
political
scene.
Except that he has ideas about what he wants to do.
You're saying he wants to go to the next level.
Yeah, he wants to go to the next level. And if he puts people first,
I think he's got a message on the whole show.
Instead of swine.
Attorney General Curtis Hill's campaign says it's set a fundraising record in the recent quarter. Curtis Hill's campaign says it's raised $220,000 in the last 2 months, a record for an attorney general candidate at this point in the cycle. Hill hasn't held any sort of official re-election bid launch event, though he's clearly been raising money. The incumbent Republican already has a GOP challenger. Zionsville attorney John Westerkamp announced last month he will seek the nomination at the Republican convention next year. And Democrats are expected to focus heavily on the race in 2020. Hill is seen as vulnerable because of allegations he groped four women, including a state lawmaker. He currently faces a lawsuit from those women and a state disciplinary commission complaint.
Nikki Kelly, how much of a shot across the bow is this from Curtis Hill?
I think he definitely wanted to show any potential challengers that he was going to be there to bring the money. It's interesting that he still hasn't announced, though. He's sort of keeping everyone waiting. Obviously, the big thing is he raised a lot of money, the majority of it from outside the state of Indiana. And last I checked, they're not going to be able to vote in the convention.
Yeah, I mean, 200...
I don't know, have you changed the rules?
We might.
200-something thousand dollars in today's world of politics and money doesn't seem like a lot, but when you're just talking about a convention fight, which is the first one he's going to have, is that a pretty big message you're sending, regardless of where the money came from?
Again, I think in the context of history, I'll go back to that, yeah, it's a lot of money. But in the modern political world where any kind of television, any kind of very aggressive direct mail campaign where you're targeting individuals who might be delegates, I mean, anything that's sophisticated is going to gobble that money up, I think, fairly quickly. So, yes, it's impressive that he departed from what we might say is sort of the patterns of pre-convention races in that for that particular job. But again, it's not going to stretch very far.
How much will money play a role in that convention fight? I mean, it's a very different kind of...
I mean, it does matter in terms of organization, your ability to, you know, keep and retain staff to work on your behalf. I mean, it's an exercise in how well organized you are, and money always helps in that effort in the context of a convention. I think, of course, it doesn't mean that much money in a general election in television.
And we've got a long time
anything,
until the general election.
We have a long time there, but you got to think in terms of... In 2020, I mean, we have a presidential campaign that is going to be a presidential campaign that is going to saturate everyone's attention.
Yep.
We have a gubernatorial race that is going to run secondary to that. How much secondary remains to be seen based on how the race shapes up. And we have this idea that this attorney general's race is going to be like front and center for people because of all these other issues. And I don't see that no matter who we nominate.
You just can't break through the noise.
You can't break through. There's not enough money out there. Not enough people care.
Does this fundraising quarter, does this number he put out put anybody off from a challenge?
Well, you already have one announced candidate on the Republican side, so I don't think it's going to put anybody off. But it makes a big difference in a convention fight. Because remember, those delegates haven't been picked yet. And if you have the organizational skills and the money for staff, you can get people to run for those delegates.
Yeah,
and
right.
I thought all along he was going to be the nominee. So this just is one more step towards that process.
All right. Well, speaking of Curtis Hill, this week he announced he will not appeal a federal judge's recent decision to temporarily halt the state's latest anti-abortion law.
The 2019 law largely bans dilation and evacuation abortions, or DNEs, the safest and most common procedure for terminating a pregnancy in the second trimester. DNEs are rare. Only a couple dozen are performed in Indiana each year. Judge Sarah Evans Barker ruled in late June the new law unconstitutionally denies women access to DNEs and stopped it from taking effect. Attorney General Hill says he won't appeal that decision. Instead, he says he'll focus on defending the law in the future legal battle over permanently striking it down.
And Delaney, will Indiana's anti-abortion activists, who Curtis Hill will need in that convention fight, be okay with his strategy here?
Look, this strategy of using taxpayer dollars to fund political campaigns, which is what this is, okay? The legislature passes bills they know are unconstitutional. And he runs in and he defends them knowing they're unconstitutional. All this has done for years is give funding to the American Civil Liberties Union. So maybe he can make the case to the anti-abortion activists that he's stopping the funding from the taxpayer dollars to the American Civil Liberties Union. Because that's all this is. And they get struck down time after time. The ACLU gets their fees in this. They go back and they pass something else that they know is unconstitutional and do it all over again. And I'd like to know how many millions of dollars that's cost taxpayers.
It is in the millions of dollars. I mean, what we know so far is it in the millions of dollars. I'll ask you the same question. For the anti-abortion activists who are politically active in the Republican Party, will they be okay with his explanation of why he didn't appeal
this decision? I think they will. I mean, the people that are focused on that strategy, on the bigger picture, on ultimately determining that Roe v. Wade is unconstitutional, will understand this. You know, and they're sophisticated enough in understanding what is trying to be done here.
He's not giving up the fight. He's just focusing on his slightly different
fight. Yeah, I mean,
frankly,
it's a distinction without a difference. He's still fighting for that law.
All right. Well, finally, the Young Democrats of America National Convention was in Indianapolis this week, as I mentioned, and one of the slogans in heavy use, particularly on social media, was Young Gets It Done. But we are in Indiana, so Mike O'Brien, did the Young Dems give Senator Todd Young his next campaign slogan?
I'd steal that all day long. You kidding me? But some of my best ideas haven't been mine.
Well, you got a free slogan from Nikki Kelly earlier in the show.
So,
I mean, I get Young Gets It Done, but in a state where your senator is Todd Young.
You know, what the heck. It's a national convention. You know, most of the people aren't from Indiana. And
I think
to have that slogan work for him, he's going to have to show the same kind of backbone that Susan Brooks showed. And I don't see that as yet from Todd Young.
Democrats I talked to at the convention say they're happy if Todd Young wants to try to use it, because if you look at that hashtag on Twitter, it's a bunch of young progressives on there. So does Todd Young still have to be careful about how much he appropriates that?
I think he can come up with another one.
And yet the Indiana Republican Party used it a lot on Twitter this week.
They probably could. But you think about it, which is an easier hashtag to not only remember, but type millennial? That's so multi-
but you could do- You could
but
do
young,
something
you
like,
know, it's right there. But
yeah, that's true. They are the young Democrats.
You could do teachers before swine or something like that that could really make a distinction.
Start pitching it to
maybe when pigs fly.
The last question we have fun with. We're not here to make policy. that's
Indiana. All done. That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette.
And you're listening to Reporters Roundtable Thursday on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. In a time when there are rising and continued tensions between police officers and the communities they serve, the town of Munster is taking part in a tradition that's designed to bring the two of them together in a positive way, National Night Out. James Grist, who is the crime prevention officer for the Munster Police Department, talked with Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson about how the National Night Out's improved this community and how it's become this tradition that has lasted in Munster for 24 years.
Tell me about what you have going in Munster, the National Night Out program, because a lot of communities have National Night Out. What makes yours a little different?
Well, we've been holding our National Night Out Against Crime celebration for 24 years now in our town, and it is truly a collaborative effort between our residents, our businesses, our community organizations, the police department, fire department, public works. Everybody works together to make it a successful event.
And what is the purpose of it?
The event is held to promote police and community partnerships through a variety of both fun and educational activities for all ages.
What relationships have you seen it improve?
Through the years that I've been involved with it, the past 16 years, we've seen a huge increase in the number of residents that are involved, the businesses that set up booths and tables along with community organizations. It's a great way for everybody to get to know each other, get to know their neighbors better. I've seen a lot more people get involved with safety programs through our police department and through our town just by being involved with the National Night Out. It's just a great way for the town to be able to get to know all of our public safety personnel up close. They can come up and talk to them and view all of our police cars and fire trucks and ambulances and safety equipment. They can see our canine. It's just a great way for them to see all of our activities, you know, participate in our activities in a fun and positive way while also getting to know our officers.
Do you think it has played a role in helping to mitigate crime, to reduce it or prevent it?
Definitely. Each year we're able to recruit a number of people for our Crime Watch program. A number of them step up to be block captains in their individual neighborhoods, and we have over 100 active neighborhood Crime Watch groups going on in Munster right now, and each year we're able to add more to that. And these are just dedicated residents that want to keep their neighborhoods safe and get to know their neighbors. A number of them then go on to hold block parties and other special events where they invite the police department and the fire department. So I think it's important for all of our safety personnel to be actively involved with our neighborhoods and with our residents so that we can keep a strong line of communication and so that everything can be safer.
So National Night Out is like a conduit between the police and the community?
Definitely. Not only do we have crime prevention information that we pass out, and not only are we be able to see all of our special equipment and all of our police cars and fire trucks and our canine and things such as that, but we also have a whole bunch of different fun things that people can do. Munster residents at night can go swimming for free, and then we also have kids' games and bounce houses. This year we're also going to have White Sox legend Ron Kittle, who played for the White Sox back in the 1980s and was the Rookie of the Year one year in 1983. He's going to be out to sign autographs and to meet and greet with the crowd. We're going to have a magic show and barrel car train rides, costume characters, DJ music. And then we have almost 100 booth participants that are going to be there that night interacting with the crowd. We also take a time to honor our residents as well. We always pick four or five residents in our town that we'd like to present citizenship awards to, and those are residents who were active in either community organizations that are directed at making Munster, keeping Munster a great place to live, or who are active with our citizens groups, or who are active in their individual neighborhoods and trying to look out for their neighbors. So in addition to all of these different things, we're trying to provide a whole bunch of different fun things for kids to do. Last but not least, we have a great fireworks show. Crazy Kaplan's Fireworks provides us with a fireworks show to close out the evening each year, and we look forward to that.
This is, you said, August 6th?
Yep, our event is on Tuesday, August 6th. The main event is at the Munster Community Pool, and that starts at 5 o'clock. But if people would like to come out to the parade, we're going to have a parade from 4:30 to about 4:50 along Columbia Avenue in the 8600 to 8800 blocks of Columbia Avenue between the school administration building and Munster High School, where people can come and kind of cheer on the police cars and fire trucks and ambulances and some student groups, community organizations. It's just a great opportunity to get everybody excited for the event that begins at 5 o'clock.
Why is community involvement so important with police work?
I think it's really important for the community to know that they can contact us when they need help. We have always had strong community policing programs, whether it be DARE or Neighborhood Crime Watch or our Cops and Kids program where we take kids shopping during the holidays. And we think it's really important for kids to grow up knowing that the police department is there for them whenever they are in trouble, or you know, they need assistance or they need advice or anything else like that, that the police department is there to support them. We also want the adults to know that whenever they have something suspicious going on in their neighborhood, we want them to be more apt to call the police. We want them to feel comfortable calling us and to know that we're there to help them.
Is there anything else that you wanted to add that maybe I haven't asked you about?
Well, we're going to have an Indiana Fallen Officers blood drive there that night. It starts at 3:30 before the event begins. It starts at 3:30 p.m. and it runs until 8:30 p.m. and it's on the grounds of the National Night Out. And it's going to be held in honor and memory of Indiana Fallen Officers. And people can just walk up, or they can call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcrossblood.org and enter the sponsor code MCPOOL. So it's MCPOOL, and they can register, pre-register their blood donation time. So we always hold that event as part of our National Night Out event each year.
Did Munster lose any officers this year?
During the past year, we had an officer who died of cancer.
Anybody in the line of duty?
No.
That's Munster Police Department DARE Crime Prevention Officer James Grist. He's talking about the department's activities in the last year and National Night Out, which is coming up on Tuesday, August 6th. And the main event's going to be at the Munster Community Pool. The event is educational, but there's entertainment involved because it involves a parade and a fireworks display. There's been a ribbon-cutting ceremony in Central Indiana for a program that has some involvement for Northwest Indiana, and we'll find out more about it. Allison Wary is the CEO of New Hope of Indiana, and they have unveiled the first-of-its-kind food truck, and we'll find out why it's so special. Allison, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first, give us an idea what New Hope of Indiana is all about.
New Hope of Indiana is a not-for-profit that provides services to people with intellectual and developmental disabilities.
What problems for someone might that encompass, for someone who's not familiar with the term?
Sure. So these are, we provide services for people that might have an intellectual disability, mm-hmm. or were born with something that would have given their children developmental delays. In Indiana, people with disabilities can stay in school until they are 22 years old. And so our programming that we're going to be talking about today are for those young adults that are leaving high school that are not quite ready to enter the job market yet. Mm-hmm. And we are hoping to provide skills for them to better ready them for jobs.
And we know the New Hope of Indiana has been around for 40 years and plus in various other projects. How did this idea of creating this cheese and thank you food truck, as it's being called, come about?
Well, as I said, kids leaving high school today are very used to being in integrated classrooms, and they want to do jobs just like everybody else. And what is the hot new thing these days? Food trucks. So we tried to think of something that would be interesting for the students leaving high school, but also a way to make our community more inclusive. I was reading some quotes from the people that are working on the food truck. We have three people working on the food truck, Eli, Michelle, and Richie. And Richie, I think, had the best quote of the day yesterday when he said, "It will prove to the whole world that people with disabilities can work as well as people without disabilities."
That's great.
And that's one of our real goals, is to bring that inclusivity and that vision to the entire community.
Now, you mentioned before we started our conversation that we have somebody from Northwest Indiana that's involved in this project. Tell us about, tell us first who that person is and what they are doing now.
Right. So Michelle is from Gary and has recently moved to Indianapolis to be with her family. But she is one of our, we call them the food truck crew. And these young people are preparing the food, which is, that's Cheese and Thank You is the name of our food truck, because our food is macaroni and cheese with toppings. We served macaroni and cheese with your choice of barbecued pork. We also have buffalo chicken and then sauteed fresh vegetables.
Wow.
They prepare the food every morning, and then we go to different locations during the week. At this point, it is a lunchtime-only service, but at the food truck, they also prepare cookies, chocolate chip cookies in the morning, so people can go and have their macaroni and cheese lunch with their cookie and a bottle of water for less than $10, so
that's
it's
good.
A pretty good deal, and young people will be doing the food prep, the food service. And then another thing that we think is also important in this is that a lot of the marketing of a food truck is through social media. So they will also learn some social media skills. They will be doing the marketing and telling people through Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, where the food truck will be. 3 days a week we'll be in a regular location, and 2 days we will be in, you know, we'll be sort of in different moving locations.
Mm-hmm.
So they will learn those skills as well. This is a year-long program, and when they are done, we've talked to other programs, Ivy Tech, if somebody wants to really go into school and have a deeper learning of those programs, they could do that. They can also, you know, go out and get a job in the food service industry, or maybe they say, hey, you know, it was a great year, but I need to try something different.
Well, I suppose everybody who feels like they can do it should at least learn something about it. It just helps your overall education, to be sure. Allison, have you had folks on your staff or get training, or you have folks on your staff that now are involved in the Cheese and Thank You food truck program that have the experience to be able to train people in food service and food prep and all that?
Yes and no. Mm-hmm. To have a licensed food truck, you have to have a food handler certificate. So, of course, we have that.
Right.
But some of this is just learn as we go. The director of the program, Kathy Ballard, who is our director of community outreach and has been at New Hope for 18 years, is herself an excellent cook. But we've had a lot of different advice, one from a local chef here in Indianapolis, Becky Hostetler. She and her husband started the Duo's food truck 10 years ago, and it was the second food truck in Indianapolis. Now you think about the food truck explosion. So
oh, yeah.
You really dates how quickly food trucks have become very popular. So she has also given us assistance and a lot of advice. So we're learning as we go, and that was one of the great things about doing the macaroni and cheese. We received that advice from somebody at Sysco Food Services who, you know, said, after all, we're in Indiana. People like macaroni and cheese in Indiana. So, you know, we can't, you know, probably pork tenderloin or whatever. It's like the Indiana food is maybe a little not right. You know, we're not, that's probably what we're not set up to do. But macaroni and cheese is something we're set up to do.
Well, I'll tell you, that's probably number two on the list if you get the equipment and get the people trained to learn to do that. But it's fine to take on mac and cheese for the initial project. A lot of people like it, and certainly people will enjoy it for lunch. They're looking to see something that's filling, but not too filling, I suppose. Since you focused around Indianapolis, obviously, because that's where your operation's based, and for this program to start, are there any plans maybe in the near future or in the future to expand out to other cities around the state?
Well, there are. I want to tell you that our board, the board of directors of New Hope, we're a not-for-profit, and they really want us to take this idea and go nationwide with it. Now, after trying to get our first, it's taken us 3 years to get the first one. You know, we had to fundraise for the truck and just, you know, there's just a lot of rules and regulations. I said, we feel like we take one step forward and then we take one step backward. But we've, you know, after 3 years, we're ready to go. So I think moving to other places may not be tomorrow, but our goal is definitely to take this to other places in the state. You know, they want to go worldwide, but I think statewide would be a great first step. And I should say the food is great. I mean, I think that anybody that tries it would like it. So I think that there really is a future to come to up to Northwest Indiana and other places throughout the state.
Well, Allison, thank you very much for telling us about cheese, and thank you. And it's not just a cheesy way to put a greeting and a reply to a greeting to somebody, but it's a great project that's going to not only benefit your stomach, it'll fill that empty stomach at lunchtime, but also, too, it's going to help mean something important for young adults with disabilities in the future. And we thank you for talking about it today.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Allison Worre is the CEO of New Hope of Indiana. It's a nonprofit organization that helps young persons with disabilities. And what they have now started with this official launch is a food truck entitled Cheese and Thank You. Yeah, they make a macaroni and cheese with all the toppings. And it's an opportunity to have a food that's prepared by, marketed, and served by young adults with disabilities. Private sector employment may have hit a tentative all-time record, and we have a coming up a rally with the residents who are not happy with what NIPSCO wants to do as far as how they bill their customers. And also, too, there's a WalletHub.com survey that's out that actually puts Indiana in a favorable light. Let's check in with Joe Pete, who's the business reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana, for the stories that he had out there. Joe, as always, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's start out here with the private sector employment report that's coming out from the state. Tell us, we almost have a new record, I guess, on this?
Yes, it looks like we're potentially at another tentative record for private sector employment in the state. The previous record had been hit in December, which had surpassed a record that dated back to like 2000 or 2001 or, you know, kind of during the height of that initial tech boom. But the estimated employment last month in the state of Indiana was about 2.75 million people working in the private sector, which is a tentative record, surpassing the more recent one set in February, all-time high for private sector employment for the state. The unemployment rate's kind of been hovering at around 3.6% all year. It dropped to 3.5%, which is more kind of negligible, but it had dropped to 3.5% last year. It's lower than the national average, and it looks like tentatively the figures could be revised by the Bureau of Labor Statistics later. But it does look like the private sector employment in Indiana is at an all-time high.
And how does Indiana rate with our neighbors here in the Midwest?
Indiana continues to have relatively high unemployment for the Midwest. It's kind of common to some of the upper Midwestern manufacturing states. There are 12 U.S. Census designated Midwestern states, and Indiana is ninth. It is only ahead of only ahead of Michigan, Illinois, and Ohio. Typically, it's usually ninth or tenth. Michigan and Illinois are the only states usually in the region that have higher unemployment. The states that are kind of more manufacturing dependent and have higher populations tend to have higher jobless rates, whereas you know, some of the more agricultural states in the Midwest, like Iowa and Kansas and so forth, tend to have, you know, historically lower unemployment.
And we know that there's a very important rally that some residents may want to check out, especially if they live in the area around Michigan City. NIPSCO customers and the Sierra Club are among the people that are putting this together this evening, a rally that is complaining about NIPSCO's electric bills. And since they're having it in Michigan City, I wonder if they're using the power plant as a backdrop.
Yes, and it's the NAACP, the Sierra Club, and NIPSCO customers will be having a rally at 6 p.m. this evening at Pullman Park on 4th Street. You should be able to see the power plant from there, the hyperbolic cooling tower. It does cast a pretty wide net, but they're concerned that their proposed rate increases of, I believe it's 12% for residential customers. The NIPSCO is looking to generate another $21.4 million in revenue for various infrastructure projects. It's been upgrading, you know, its electric infrastructure all across the region. It's installing new lines right now by helicopter in Highland and Munster, for instance. However, it is looking at reducing the effective rate of some of its large manufacturing companies by 19%. They're talking about BP, US Steel, ArcelorMittal, Praxair, NLMK. They roughly account for about half of the energy use already from NIPSCO, and they're part of the reason it had grown into a Fortune 500 company, because we have the massive heavy industry here along the lakeshore, the steel mills, the refineries, those types of things eat up a lot of power, and they help NIPSCO grow a lot over the years. However, currently, the customers are concerned because they're saying it's a shift in, it's shifting it from these big corporations, which in some cases, you know, turn billions of dollars of profit every year, to, you know, homeowners and renters, and the actual residents are going to be shouldering more of the burden. Yeah. NIPSCO's perspective, they're saying that, you know, now a lot of these larger energies, there's been some decline, like there's been decline in energy uses with the steel mills. Some of that isn't as like thriving as it used to be. And then also a lot of these big industrial users are now capable of generating their own power. You know, there's a lot of alternative technologies like solar and wind turbines and things of that nature. And it's becoming a trend for a lot of these companies to kind of cut their power bills by installing their own renewable energy generation. And NIPSCO is wanting to try and preserve as much of the industrial business as they can, and saying that they need to restructure it so to encourage these companies to get at least most of their power from NIPSCO, even if they're going to supplement it. And in order to do so, they have to make it so it's reducing their overall effective rate. They're saying that, you know, if some of these mills and plants go offline, it would effectively raise prices even higher for the residential consumers.
Do you get the impression in talking with business and industry here in Northwest Indiana that there are all that many companies, factories out there that are going to or thinking very seriously about going to alternative energy sources opposed to NIPSCO?
Well, yes, the new project, the data center at the State Line Generating Plant at the Hammond Chicago State Line, they are actually installing, I believe it's wind turbines, and part of the reason was they thought the NIPSCO, they're also a very heavy energy user. They're running tons and tons of, will be running tons and tons of computer servers to store data for, you know, Netflix or online shopping or, you know, anything you're really doing on your computer. And they were kind of, the NIPSCO rates they found kind of off-putting, so they were looking to put in some alternative energy generation to kind of help reduce their electricity bills. And it's a trend that will probably only grow more and more pronounced as the cost of some of those, you know, some of those technologies used to be kind of cost prohibitive, but now it's like they've become established enough and the technology is there where that's actually becoming cheaper and more affordable. So you're seeing kind of an ongoing shift, and a lot of these companies will look to do anything that's going to reduce their bottom line. And, you know, you're seeing it with one, you know, big user of electricity that's going to be coming to the lakeshore over the next year or two.
Every once in a while, we come up with these surveys that come out, highest and lowest, worst and best and all. WalletHub.com is good at putting these out on a regular basis. In fact, we've had a chance to talk with some of the people from WalletHub.com about some of these. But the latest one actually does put Indiana in a very favorable light. And that's one of the stories that you've had out there, too, about the new study about how credit card debt is being handled and how does Indiana seem to fare in their survey.
Yes, they found that Indiana had the most manageable credit card debt in the country. It didn't necessarily have the lowest credit card bill. It was like eighth, I think, or so in that. But when they looked at median income and the exact amount of time it would take to repay, they found that Indiana residents kind of had the most sustainable amount of credit card debt. And it's they're one of those companies that puts out that information. Studies like that kind of promote themselves. They're a financial, services firm, but they found that Hoosiers have an average of about $2,313 in credit card debt, which, you could pay off in 9 months and 29 days at a cost of $167 in interest on the state's median income of $42,438. I've seen other studies that have placed Indiana kind of higher in the amount of debt they carry. A lot of this is there are a lot of different data sources from which you can draw this, but they found that Illinois was 37th with about $2,600 in credit card debt. It would take about 12 months to pay off. Mm-hmm. But it's nationally the credit card debt is rising almost exponentially, which is common when there's a strong economy and people are employed. But we're at about over $1 trillion now in credit card debt.
Well, Joe, thank you very much for the info from these reports and this in particular about the latest on household credit card debt. Appreciate you being with us today and I hope to have you back on again real soon.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Joe Pete is a business reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. Our thanks to the folks who have been with us today, with besides Joe Pete, of course, with the Times of Northwest Indiana, with the folks with Indiana Week in Review, Brandon Smith from Indiana Public Broadcasting as the anchor and host of the program. Also, too, to Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson for her report and talking to people about National Night Out and the upcoming ceremony and program that's planned in the town of Munster. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today and this week. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back with you on Monday.